All across the country today, the so-called hands-off demonstrations sending a message to the White House and the Trump administration. Pittsburgh's Action News 4 reporter Carlos Flores tells us thousands of people here want their voices to be heard.
People were here in front of the city county building earlier today protesting the recent actions by the Trump administration, joining many more across the country.
It was a simple message voiced by thousands. Hands off.
We're here to say hands off our country, hands off Medicare, hands off Medicaid, hands off LGBTQ lives. That as normal Americans, this is not normal.
The rally in downtown was put together by Indivisible Pittsburgh, along with several other organizations, including the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers, the League of Women Voters, and Casa San Jose. Many people speaking on how President Donald Trump's first couple months in office should raise concerns. Mayor Ed Gainey attending today's rally and voicing similar frustrations.
My office will do everything in their power to ensure that people's civil rights and civil rights are being respected.
The rally in Pittsburgh joins rallies across the country, including a county over in Westmoreland County.
I'm here fighting for the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all the necessities that lower income people need. I blame Congress for letting Trump run rampant over us, and we're having none of this.
Both rallies called for unity.
And there are actually so many people here in this county who believe in this country and everything it stands for. We were able to bring in, it sounds like, maybe 700 people today who are taking a stand. There are Democrats here, there are Republicans here, there are kids and dogs here. We are happy for anyone who wants to stand up against what's happening in this country right now.
This is unprecedented unity. When you see this type of unity in the city, it lets everybody know that we're going to fight back all that we can.
Now, officials with Pittsburgh police say a woman reported being assaulted in the crowd during that rally. I'm being told that police are looking into the matter. Other than that, we are told that it was peaceful and there were no other issues. Reporting in front of the city county building in downtown, Carlos Flores.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT 88.3 FM. Today, we're going to be talking to Maxwell Jones, PhD student in the Computer Science Department at Carnegie Mellon University, about AI. Thanks for coming on the show, Max.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Arjun. I'm super excited to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I started my undergrad at CMU, actually, Carnegie Mellon, doing an AI major. So I was in the computer science department doing an AI major, and I also actually did an additional math major. After that, I did a master's in machine learning in the machine learning department at CMU, which was super fun. So I guess for my master's work, I did some research on style transfer with generative models for images. So this is like, you can think of generating an image, and you want to generate an image in a certain style. And so the problem was kind of some specific version of that. During undergrad, I did some research as well. Not as much, but I did some theoretical machine learning research because I liked math. So I thought maybe I would like some theory. I ended up not liking it as much, but it ended up being cool. And I also did some fairness and bias research during undergrad. So you can think of, like, you know, after a model is trained, you know, does it work the same on people of different races? What kind of correlations are there between captions outputted by a model and biases that humans have or biases that might be in the data? So after that, I started a PhD in the School of Computer Science, actually in the machine learning department. But I'm co-advised by one advisor in the machine learning department. So it's like Ruslan. He is like a super well-known, well-respected person in machine learning. He invented some of the seminal work in machine learning. So his PhD advisor was Geoffrey Hinton, who's like very well known and like just got a Nobel Prize recently. So that's exciting. And I'm also co-advised with Junyan Zhu, who's in the Robotics Institute. And he does more generative model stuff. So I worked with him during my master's. And I guess now I'm kind of interested in sequential decision making or agentic processes for vision, creative tasks. And I guess my long-term plan is to work in some video editing. So how can we make video editing easier for creators? How can we create tools to kind of be a prayer programmer or to help creators make cool stuff with videos? So, yeah.
Sure. That's really cool stuff. So all of the new talk these days has been about large language models like ChatGPT, mm-hmm. And now the news about DeepSeek. Could you give a quick explanation to the audience on sort of how large language models work for the layman?
Yeah, sure. So I guess at their core, they take in words, right? Like I'll say, I don't know, what team did Michael Jordan play on when he was playing basketball? And so it takes in a sequence of words. And then it outputs a sequence of words. So this example could be like, maybe it'll output, oh, Michael Jordan played basketball for the Chicago Bulls. And maybe it'll even give you more information like, you know, he played in predominantly in the 90s where he won 6 championships. From an input-output standpoint, that's what's going on. And then like more formally, you kind of have some neural network, which is really just like a large set of numbers, weights, whatever you want to say. It's a function that takes in these words, transforms them into numbers, into vectors, and then does a bunch of operations on them, and then outputs the words. And so I guess there's all this talk of training. Basically, how like a large language model is trained is you just get sequences of words from somewhere. So typically this is like from the internet, and then you train the model to be able to predict the sequences of words that you've seen so far. Right? So maybe on the internet, there's sequences of words like, oh, you know, what was Michael Jordan's favorite game to play? Well, he loved playing basketball. Maybe you train on that data. And I guess nowadays, the large part of large language models comes from the fact that you're training on whatever millions, billions, even like a trillion like words or tokens, which is like a kind of small building block that a word is made out of to the model.
Thanks for that explanation. So over the past couple of years, LLMs, ChatGPT, and generative AI in general, kind of like some of those generative image models that you were talking about earlier, have really come into vogue in the mainstream media, and everyone's mm-hmm. hearing about it. And there seems to be a lot of investment dollars and work going into it.
Yeah.
But machine learning as a discipline has existed for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the factors that you think have created this shift or explosion in interest in machine learning more broadly, as well as technical innovations that you think kind of led us here? What are the most important ones?
So there's kind of two things. So the first is like ease of use. So I think ChatGPT was a big watershed moment for generative AI, as a lot of people will say. And one of the main things is because anyone could use it for free on their computer. Right? So it didn't require a special hardware or you to kind of have research machines to run the like neural networks or run the machine learning models. All you had to do was log into a website and then type something and something would come back, right? And so that's kind of what led to many millions of people trying it out for the first time. And I think that's what led to like people investing, saying, oh, this can be very useful, because people started to notice that, you know, ChatGPT knew about so much stuff. It knew about whatever use case they were trying to work on. And so then from, a more technical side, one of the main innovations with ChatGPT over previous large language models is this like idea of RLHF, or reinforcement learning for human feedback. And so without going into too much depth, I think the main idea here is that you don't only want to kind of reconstruct things you've seen online, but you kind of want to pick something that you think a human is really asking you about. So I guess the example that I like to go to for something like this is, let's say I train on a bunch of workbooks and a bunch of text from the internet. That's not a workbook, right? So maybe a workbook has questions like, oh, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by, oh, what is the capital of France? And maybe other things have words like, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by Washington, D.C. And so as a user, if I input in ChatGPT, what is the capital of the United States? I want it to give me the answer, Washington, D.C. But the training data might say, well, it's equally likely to predict what is the capital of France as the next line, because it's seen those two lines next to each other a lot in the training data. So this idea of reinforcement learning with human feedback is saying, well, actually, you should really output Washington, D.C. in these examples, because you should kind of have an idea. You should learn what humans are looking for. And so there was kind of some seminal work in that domain that really made ChatGPT super good.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about resource consumption with AI and how mm-hmm. that's going to be a growing concern as time goes on. And obviously, NVIDIA has become one of the world's largest companies off the back of powering AI training and inference. Can you explain to the audience a little bit why it requires such massive computing resources to run these models, and why these resources are so specialized to companies like NVIDIA?
So I guess, yeah, there's two questions. One is, why does it require so much resources? And so one of the things that like the AI community has found in the last 10 years is that the way to have a better model is to have a bigger model trained on more data. So if you want to have a general model that can do a lot of stuff, the best way to achieve that is by getting a lot of high quality data and training a very large model. And so improvements in the field of large language models or just general models in general, which is what, like, a normal user wants to use, like a general model that can do a lot of stuff, then the best thing to do is make a bigger and bigger model that's trained with more and more data. And so as you get bigger and bigger models, right, the cost of consumption goes up. And so it's actually one thing that's important to note here is that the training of the model isn't actually like the majority of the bulk of the consumption. What's the bulk of the consumption is users querying the model, you know, millions or hundreds of millions of times, whereas you only have to train the model once. So I think that's basically the real reason. And then this NVIDIA question is kind of a separate question. So they have like the best like GPUs, graphical processing units that people can buy. And that's like a chip that you use to train a model. And so because they have the best things to use to train the model and everyone wants to train the model, then they're super rich, right? So their main customer isn't like the layperson like you or me or anyone who's trying to use these models. It's like OpenAI or Meta or other companies that are trying to train models at a very, very large scale who need to buy these in bulk, right? And they're like pretty expensive per graphical processing unit or GPU.
Cool. So one of the things that's been in the news a lot recently is DeepSeek, and I know you've looked into it yourself a little bit. Can you explain what the hubbub was about with DeepSeek? Why was it such big news that they came out with their model?
So I guess, like, just going from what we were talking about before, like OpenAI has this, they have their ChatGPT, which everyone uses, which a lot of people use, which is like super valuable, and they've raised a lot of money, right? And when they talk to investors, they say, hey, we need all this money because training is super expensive, GPUs are very expensive, and the more money we have, the better we can train. We can hire good people to train our models, right? We can hire smart people to train our models. And so we need all this money, right? And then Meta and all these companies that are buying NVIDIA chips are saying, hey, we need all this money in order to train our models so we can have the best model. The assumption is, hey, you give us all this money now, we'll train our models. And then in the future, you're going to get your profits back because we're going to have these models and everyone's going to use them and there's going to be some pay structure and somehow you're going to get your money back. Right. So DeepSeek was a model trained by this like DeepSeek team in China. It's like a quantitative firm. They do some large language model training also. So like the large language model isn't their profit structure. It's more about like, you know, doing stuff in the market, some kind of financial math stuff. And so they trained a model, which they open sourced. So that means like not only can you use it like via a website, like the actual weights themselves are online. So anyone could download the model in theory and run it kind of either not locally, but they could run it without having to pay DeepSeek at all because they have the weights. And so they trained this model, released it, open sourced it so anyone could in theory download the weights. And it was on par or almost on par with the top models from like these US companies, so like OpenAI. I think the Meta model is not quite as good as the OpenAI model, or Google has a good model as well. And so I think the scare was, if we give these companies all this money, however, like another company could train a model that's just as good or basically indistinguishable that people could use for free, then kind of where's the profit coming back? So I think about this as a reason for like all the big market hubbub, as opposed to, oh, it only costed X dollars to train the model. So I think something that a lot of people will talk about is, oh, it only costs whatever, $5 million to train this DeepSeek model, whereas OpenAI kind of, you know, has asked for so much money, right? But I think one thing that's good to separate is like the cost of training a model from the cost of the research and development to know how to train the model correctly and the cost of trying a lot of stuff out before you do your final single training run, right? So this cost of research and development and figuring out, you know, what the best model looks like, how to get the best data, how to clean the best data, right? That's where like all the costs are, as opposed to a single training a single model, right? So I think something I like to think about is, you know, they're a kind of a quantitative finance company, right? So maybe, and the paper itself had like whatever 40 or 50 people on it, right? So you can think, and they've been working on this kind of direction of machine learning for 4 or 5 years, Right. So in the U.S., how much would the salary of 40 or 50 quantitative research finance people over 4 or 5 years cost? It's a lot of money, right? 40 people times 4 years times salaries north of $500K to $1 million to $2 million for a senior quantitative research person. So it's not as if this entire process costs $5 million. It costs significantly more, right? But even with that being said, there's still a question of, is this monetizable if there's always a free version of the top model, right? So that's still a question.
Interesting. So you would think that the human capital is like a pretty significant portion.
Yeah, that's the main portion of it, is the human capital and also the capital needed to train different testing runs, right? So when I look at the DeepSeek model and I look at their tech report, like every single part of the process is clearly, to me, optimized very thoroughly, and many things are tested. Right, so maybe I'll just say a number. There's 50 different things you could have tested, right? They've tested all of those and figured out what works better than previous things for a lot of different parts. So that process of even testing those things, just the money to train different versions, is going to cost whatever, 10x, 100x, the $5 million used for the final training.
Sure. You talked about open source models, and Obviously DeepSeek V3 and R1 are open source models, mm-hmm. where the weights are publicly available. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as an increasing trend in AI, and what are some of the impacts of having these large models open sourced?
So this is actually a good question. And so the head of the machine learning department is Zico Coulter, and he's one of the board members for OpenAI. So I think he had some interesting takes about open source versus closed source as well. So I guess there are some companies that swear by open source, some companies that basically like only do closed source. So an example is like these DeepSeek, all of their model weights are open, right? Meta, all of the model weights are open. OpenAI, no model weights are open. But at the same time, there's kind of a continuum of open source, right? So maybe on the completely closed end, right, is something like OpenAI, where all you can do is input text and output, and the model will output something. You don't know how big it is. You don't know how many weights there were. You don't know what it was trained on. You don't know anything about it. Right? A little bit farther down this kind of trajectory is like a Meta model or a DeepSeek model, where they'll give you the weights, but they won't tell you what training data was used to train the model. Right? And they'll give you a paper saying, hey, these are all the things we did. Right? But they'll say the data set contained this many words, but we're not going to tell you where it came from. Right, so this also isn't actually fully reproducible, right? Because you don't actually have the data that they used. And then on the other end is kind of something that's completely open. And so completely open, I think there's some examples. I think the Allen Institute for AI has some completely open stuff, where that means they tell you the data set, you know, they tell you what the model looks like, they give you the model weights, and they write a tech report about everything that happened, as well as all their failures. And given that information, you have enough information to perfectly reproduce their model, right? So you should ideally be able to get up to some level of error, like the exact same weights or very similar weights, right? So when people say DeepSeek is open, it's definitely more open than an OpenAI model, but it's not open in the sense that given the DeepSeek paper and infinite money, someone could reproduce their model exactly because the data is not released.
Interesting. Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arjun Das, here with Maxwell Jones, AI researcher at CMU. Speaking of CMU, obviously a lot of really cool ML research happens here that you're aware of. What are some cool research or researchers that you would like to shout out as being particularly interesting at the moment?
So I guess I first want to shout out, I think my lab members are doing some really cool stuff. First, Shengyu Wang, who is working on data attribution. So this is actually a very hard problem. The idea is, let's say I trained my image generator on 5 billion images from the internet. And then I say, hey, generate me an image of a cat wearing a top hat. And I get some cat wearing a top hat. Right? The question is, can I figure out which of those training images were very influential into making that cat with a top hat? And I guess the main idea is, if I know that, then maybe I can give those artists some residual pay, right? So you can think of an artist opts into getting trained to using their data to train with a model. And then from there, if the model generates an image that was based upon their work, they get some residual fee, right? This is actually an incredibly difficult problem from a mathematical and machine learning perspective. So Shengyu is doing some really cool work. I think also Gaurav Parmar and Nupur Kumari are doing some really cool stuff in the field of image translation and customization. So image translation is like, say you have an image of a car during the day. Can I turn it into an image of a car, like raining, right? Or can I turn it into an image of a car when it's cloudy outside? And so one application of this is like data augmentation for self-driving, right? So I guess more concretely, if I have a bunch of self-driving videos from the day, it'd be cool if I could generate self-driving videos during rain so I can use that to train to make a very strong self-driving car that I think will work in all cases. And then customization is kind of the idea of I have some personal images. Maybe I have some photos of myself. Maybe I have some selfies of myself. And then I want to generate like a high-resolution professional headshot of myself, right? And so in this case, I'm only giving the model 5 to 10 images of myself as opposed to whatever it was trained on, like billions of images. And then can it use that kind of scarce data and its general knowledge about humans to then output a photo of me, but like say in a professional suit and in a headshot.
A lot of really neat stuff. Thanks. So speaking of these generative image and video models that you and your lab are working on, what do you see as some of the important implications in the future and potential uses? Obviously, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but where do you see the impact of this work?
So I think there's a few things. So I think there's kind of two areas that this technology can be very useful. And I think it's maybe a little bit different than what people think. So when people think of like, oh, I have like an image generation tool, they think of like, oh, like it's very negative. It's usually from a very negative connotation of, oh, it's going to replace someone. And so I think of it more as like someone with these tools can generate cool stuff much faster and can iterate on stuff much faster. So I'll give you two examples of like an expert with these tools being able to iterate much faster in the movie world, right? So first, like the movie Into the Spider-Verse, right? There was experts on the team that was like kind of designing, and they had AI tools that they could use to speed up their design process, to try things faster. And so to me, the result of this kind of technology is that experts can make a high quality movie faster, right? So we don't have to wait whatever 6 years for the next Into the Spider-Verse movie, which no one would like to do. We'd like to have a really high quality version in 3 years, right? That's as high quality as a version in 6 years without the technology, right? So I kind of think of it as a continuation of any image editing software in some sense where it speeds up the use for creators. Another use case is helping people who are typically non-creators create high quality stuff that they can be proud of and learn more quickly, right? So one example for me is like in the future, I'd love to make more YouTube videos, right? But some software like Adobe Premiere Pro or other video editing software is very, there's a lot of different tools you could use. It's very cumbersome, right? So it would be good if like AI could help me as a creator or someone that wants to be a creator create very high quality videos like immediately without all the overhead, right? Or could help me learn more quickly what a good quality video looks like. So I think this is another use case is kind of helping people who are not in the space or who want to get in the space, like create things more quickly.
You speak of generative AI almost as like a force multiplier, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, something like that. And there's also like 3D assets or gaming is also another example that's kind of along these similar lines.
Yeah, so for our listeners who aren't machine learning researchers at CMU, but still want to use AI for positive impact in their own work, what are some ways that they can go about learning how to use these tools to boost their output?
That's actually that's a good question. So there's a few things, I guess. So first of all, the internet is a great tool. So you can look up stuff. Nowadays, if I want to learn about something, I don't know that much about it and I can't find it like via Google search, I'll just ask ChatGPT like, hey, I want to learn more about X thing. What are a set of things I should look up? Also, there's different AI tooling, especially in the generative AI space that's more accessible, that doesn't require super fancy hardware. So for example, a tool might be like Comfy UI is a tool. It's like a user interface for kind of using these models. So I think that has like a relatively low barrier to entry as opposed to like trying to code up something fancy.
Sure. In general, what are some tasks that you see AI being really good at? And what are some tasks where it really still has some room to go?
So I guess And I was talking with some other like PhD friends about this. It seems like tasks where you're kind of just sitting around and like doing something on a computer like should be very automatable, especially kind of tasks that are not super long term, where you're kind of sitting down and like typing or doing something that doesn't require any like interaction with the real world as much. So one example might be like writing reports, like writing write-ups. Any write-up where really all where what you're doing is kind of looking things up online, synthesizing information, writing things up in a certain format that's very nice, I think AI could be very good at. Right? Another example might be in the coding world, it might be kind of fixing a single error in like a coding library or like a some kind of repository. I think that kind of task AI can be and will be very good at. Right? All these tasks are in some ways still kind of short term in the sense that you don't have to do stuff for a very long time. So some things that AI in general is bad at is just anything in the real world. Right? So robotics as a field hasn't hit its kind of ChatGPT moment, as some researchers like to say, where it's very widely adopted and everyone is kind of using kind of generalist robots. Right? And so the reason for that is just manipulating things in the real world is just harder. Right? It's harder to iterate. It's harder to test a robot 10 times than it is to test some code 10 times. It's just fundamentally harder, takes longer. So I think that's an area where AI still has a long way to go. And then another area where AI might have a long way to go is kind of long horizon tasks. Right? So I think one example is AI can perfectly pass maybe a job interview for coding where you're asked two very short questions. But can AI perform like a long-term like intern? Maybe this is more unclear. Right? And so I think people are working towards kind of this direction. But anything where there's super, super long like content that you have to create, I think is like much more difficult. Yeah, there's some types of things that AI I think might be like not as good at in kind of the social, like human aspect. So maybe like being able to synthesize new memes or something. Like something that's like you have to be really in tune with the culture to do. But I could eat my words on that one. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Watch out for the new meme AI model dropping in 2025,
right? Oh, God. Well, I guess we'll see. People will definitely try.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to come soon, if it hasn't already.
Yeah, I know there's like YouTube creators that just do like, they do video essays where they like synthesize the video and like the and the script with AI. And so that's kind of, I don't know. I like a use case where kind of you kind of have thoughts as a human and then you use AI as a mode to try to, you know, get them out there more quickly.
Yeah.
Or iterate sense. On them more quickly, yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing a really interesting perspective on what AI is good at and bad at, that things that are like really easy or instinctual for humans actually end up being the things that AI is bad at.
Yeah, like, it's weird.
You could teach a five-year-old to catch a ball, but to teach a robot like how to move its motors to like, I don't know, play hockey or something is like very difficult. But you see little kids playing hockey everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things. I think I forgot who it was. Maybe Ilya or some big AI mogul said it has like this kind of jagged intelligence where the point is it can do highly intelligent things, but it still cannot do very simple things. So like it learns in a different way than humans are used to, in the sense that it can do very complicated things while still failing to do very simple things, right? And so then the question is, how can you augment an AI to know when that's the case or to do what that or kind of to not have to do that kind of thing? So one example might be like multiplication, right? Like you can make an AI that knows a lot of stuff but then still maybe struggles with 10-digit multiplication. Right? But if the AI says, hey, you gave me a 10-digit multiplication question, let me just use a calculator, like maybe you can kind of patch some of these issues.
So as AI has been in the popular mind for a few years now, more so than ever before, do you think it's here to stay in terms of how people think about it? Or do you think this sort of initial burst of attention is going to go away?
I don't know. I think it's here to stay. And it's easy for me to say that as someone who works in the field, but especially after talking to like other people who aren't in the field or are like... like even like in like high ranking roles at CMU or other places where you'd expect them to be like more likely to say that it's not here to stay. I think everyone thinks it's here to stay. And maybe the reason is that especially this generative AI stuff, it's so easy to use and it can give so much value that that value will kind of like circumcide any attempts to completely like stop it, is in my opinion. I think there's so much value that it can be output to make people's lives easier that people will just continue to use it. And whether the people think about it differently is another question. But I think there's a lot of value in people continuing to use this tool. But one thing I will say is with humans in general, like, we go through cycles of having super cool new technology or something that's super cool and new, not knowing how to use it. And then after we know how to use it, it takes us even longer to realize why it might be good or bad, and then to kind of die down a little bit using it. So one example might be like smartphones, for instance, right? So smartphones first came out, whatever, 2000s, right? They got so much hype. Everyone started using them, right? And to me, it's now or in the next 10 years that people are going to start being like, hey, it's actually really bad that I'm spending so much time on my phone. Can I find really good ways to not do this, right? Because we're not used to it. It's almost like a... it's like maybe like drinking in moderation or something, where when you're first introduced to drink, you don't even know what it is, right? So you're thinking, oh, like, I can do this a lot. And once you start to realize the downfalls, it takes even longer to be like, okay, how can I work on this, right? So kind of humanity goes through these things as well. And so I think this is something that happened with smartphones, where people kind of use them a lot. To me, we're kind of peaking in terms of how much we use them. And then people are kind of slowly being like, I actually really do enjoy like human connection. So in the last, whatever, year, I've heard more and more stories of people being like, yeah, I try to use my phone as little as possible, or I'm actively trying to stop using my phone, which is something that maybe wasn't as true 5 years ago. So I really think that AI will go through something similar, where kind of right now everyone is using it, and in the future, maybe next 5 years, 10, depends, timeline is hard to say when things move so quickly, it'll get even more widely adopted and people will use it for many, many tasks. And then maybe at some point people will be like, we're actually losing some stuff for using it so much. But I think this is... if this is going to happen, very far away.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm your host, Archin Das, and I've been here with AI researcher at CMU, Maxwell Jones. Thanks. Have a good one, folks. Give you every dollar, making it so hard to walk away from. We could be taking our time, but I got you losing your mind. Have you missed some wishing you could get some? In my old day, in my old day, yeah, yeah. I'm
the vision that we have for these wearables. A tremendous equalizing technology who has incredible memory, incredible vision, incredible hearing. Some people are born that just have those talents. The vagaries of the bell curve and the ranges of human capabilities are beyond just the demographic ones. They exist in terms of fundamental capabilities. And how interesting will we be as a society if everyone has the full access to those facilities?
Hi, I'm Reid Hoffman.
And I'm Aria Finger.
We want to know how together we can use technology like AI to help us shape the best possible future.
We ask technologists, ambitious builders, and deep thinkers to help us sketch out the brightest version of the future. And we learn what it'll take to get there.
This is possible. It's no surprise that innovations in tech are changing the way we interact with each other. But now, we're living in an era where devices and programs are changing the way we interact in the physical world. And they're doing so through advancement in augmented reality, virtual reality, and of course, AI.
The future is already here, and it is quickly redistributing more evenly. And while we talk a lot about software, it's happening increasingly with wearables, namely electronic devices designed to blend seamlessly into our everyday lives, like watches, clothing, and glasses. However, these aren't just fun gadgets, but devices that could refactor how we navigate our world.
Our world is soon to be one where glasses don't just help you see, but where they enhance what you see. Now, add AI to the equation. The glasses could potentially guide you, talk to you, and troubleshoot your problems while keeping you rooted in the physical world. The possibilities and applications in this space continue to grow.
One of the key figures shaping the future of this technology is Andrew Boz Bosworth, Meta's chief technology officer and the head of Reality Labs. Boz has spent nearly two decades at the forefront of digital innovation. He joined Facebook back in 2006, where he developed pivotal features like the newsfeed, Messenger, and Groups, those functions playing a crucial role in transforming Facebook into the tech giant that it is today. But his influence doesn't stop there.
Boz's journey in tech runs deep. From his early days as a teaching fellow for an AI course at Harvard, working on Microsoft Visio, and later founded Meta's AR and VR division, which became Reality Labs. Today, as Meta builds towards the metaverse, Boz is focused on the next frontier in mixed realities. His latest project, Orion, a next-generation pair of AR glasses still in development, aims to revolutionize how we interact with the digital and physical world while striving to make this groundbreaking technology accessible to a wider audience.
In this episode, we'll be diving into the intersections of Boz's career, Meta's ambitious AI hardware projects, and the broader implications of having AI and mixed reality in our day-to-day lives.
So let's get into it. Here's our conversation with Boz. So you were part of the California program where you raised livestock and essentially grew up on a farm, which, by the way, I went to a high school on a farm, so I'm very sympathetic. I'm curious, how did that experience influence the person you are today?
People are often surprised by the fact that, you know, I grew up on a farm, and my family's farming from way back and still is farming to this day. But actually, really, if you know about farmers, three things that are important to know about farmers. Number one is they're governed by time, daylight, and seasons. They have X number of daylight hours to which they get the work done, and they got to get it done because the seasons are moving forward. And that forces two other things. The first one is every one of them is an engineer. You got to fix that tractor now because you got to get that crop done. You got to mend that fence today. You don't have time to be dealing with getting these livestock back in the pen. So they're all engineers, not scientists. I mean, real, like, get it done with what you have on hand kind of engineers. And the second one is they're entrepreneurs. You know, my family runs a horse ranch. Well, a horse ranch means you got a lot of manure. Well, you got two ways to handle that. The one is you can pay someone to pick that manure up and haul it off, and that's going to cost you money. The second one is you can market that manure as a fertilizer, and you can make a little money. That's a, you know, two for one swing. And so my cousins who are still farming and my uncles who are still farming, it's either a cost or an opportunity. Then the margins are slim. So you got to make those opportunities work. You know, in my experience, at least, it's not as big a stretch as people thought. But I do want to shout out National 4-H Organization and California State 4-H. I learned how to program in 4-H. It's not just cows and cooking, as we like to say. The first person who taught me to program was a fellow 4-H'er and got me into computers that way. So it's a great program, not just from a entrepreneurial and engineering standpoint, but also directly programming computers.
Was there anything in addition in the kind of farming that also shaped how you think about the interface between the digital and physical worlds?
Well, it's interesting. I think the point that humans are busy, they got a lot of things on their plate, and the tool either has to work for them or it's just not worth it. I really think that when we think about how we build these tools, a lot of times we're beset by the tremendous value that we see, especially in our industry. We see how great it could be. And this isn't new. This goes back to Douglas Engelbart, right, who invented the mouse. To some degree, his vision at SRI failed because he had such a complex idea. He wanted humans to do a ton of work to get skilled enough to unlock the full power of the machine. And my understanding is even in his retirement, you know, late in the 90s, he lamented the fact that we took the easy exit. We took the computer mouse and we ran with it and just did this point and click stuff, whereas he wanted to replace the keyboard with the cord set. Like, he had all these ideas. And I think that's a lesson we keep relearning, which is like, it has to be so easy. Like, the big pot of value at the end is great, but it still has to be so, so easy to get at it that you can lead people down that path. If they have to take a course to learn how to do it, they're not going to do it. It doesn't matter how valuable it is. And that's nothing to do with anything but just how humans are. But that's true in a wood shop. That's true in an auto shop. The tool that you can pick it up and you're like, yep, I see it. I get it. I use it. It works. That's the tool people reach for time and time again, not the super elaborate, complex one. I think about that all the time. That was the truth growing up on a farm, is you had to get it done. You didn't have time to be trying to learn a new thing. You had to get it done.
So I love that way to start, because when people think about technology, at least lately, they think so much about the digital world, and it feels like there's nothing more real world than like working on a farm and using tools to fix your equipment and making sure the cows get milked and sort of all that stuff that's in the real world. But we're in this new era, this new ecosystem of device wearables and smartphones and, of course, glasses. And so how do you think about sort of this new world where we're actually going to navigate and engage with the physical world through digital in a way that we used to interact with digital spaces?
Yeah, this is the construct of the metaverse, which I think has been pretty broadly misunderstood, or at least is understood differently by different people, is this idea of blending of the digital and the physical together. Actually, let's keep with the farming thing, because that's great. Farmers are pioneering some amazing work. You know, autonomous driving is not as far along as autonomous farming is. You know, tractors that are able to plow the fields automatically, drones that are out there doing reconnaissance on what fields need what kind of treatment. That is actually pretty advanced technology. And it really is very much about blending the physical and the digital capabilities together. And so we had this amazing explosion with the internet and software. And I think we took software as far as it could go within the construct of a phone, a laptop. It's like we just took it to the absolute limit. And what's exciting me now is these really physical manifestations where through advanced sensors, whether it be audio, mechatronics, whether it be drones or robotics, automation, and then ultimately, I think through wearable devices, we're getting to a new plateau of hardware that can further allow software to breathe and expand. AI is such a fun example because it's so vogue right now. And if people have had a chance to ignore all the hype and really try to use these tools in their daily lives, there are some areas where it's mind-blowingly useful. You know, I'm doing a little home automation project and I'm debugging, and there's these obscure, you know, Internet of Things devices that have unlisted APIs. And it would take me a long time to build a fuzzer to discover those. Man, you can do it in minutes with these tremendously useful AIs. Of course, there's a ton of things that they're not good at, but I still find the interface to them very awkward, where I'm going to my phone, or I'm going, whether it's voice or text, it's this very transactional thing. And what's so funny, I find myself, I'm like the cut and paste machine suddenly, like I'm doing a coding project here and I'm like, okay, I got to cut this result, the debugger output into here. And then it gives me the answer and I'm cutting and pasting back into the thing. This should all be integrated.
So let's broaden out to AI generally. I mean, like, I'm enough of a geek and the interface with kind of the digital and the physical world and how that transforms what it is to be human and homo technic. I could spend the entire discussion on this, which will be amazing. But there's also AI
more broadly. So what's the meta view of AI and in use in products, use in the world? What is the AI philosophy?
So there's three layers to this in my mind. The first one is we're building these very exciting models. And I find myself actually sometimes at war with both sides of the AI discussion. I have a profound belief that these are hugely important, meaningful things that will meaningfully advance human capability. I kind of liken it to a word calculator, right? In the year 1960, a calculator was a person. In the year 1970, it was not a person anymore. It was a different thing. And at first they like ban them from school and get rid of them. And I grew up in the, you want to have a calculator with you at all times. I have three calculators with me at all times. My high school teachers were wrong about that. I think of the AIs that we are building as word calculators. I really mean that word image, like visually, they're really complex calculators that have moved beyond the simple symbolic space of mathematics into this higher order space. I also don't think it is even the kind of thing that is human intelligence as we understand intelligence and agency and consciousness and thought. And so I have to fight both sides. Like, AI is both a huge deal and also not that kind of a huge deal. So that's like my first kind of belief about it, which gives me tremendous, you know, confidence in how I use the tool. The second one is we're running into the information theoretic limits of it. If you go all the way back to like Norbert Wiener and his cybernetics of the first, you know, constructs of information theory.
Hi there, I'm Pi, and I'm here to add some context. Norbert Wiener's construct of information theory can be explained in simple terms as the study of how information flows and is used to control systems, including mechanical, biological, and social systems. His work on feedback loops and data processing laid the foundation for modern control systems.
This idea of how many bits can we pull out of something that are sufficiently generalizable bits. And we're finding out that for all the corpus of human media ever produced, it's not enough. It's not enough. We're finding that in robotics. Robotics is an effort that we kicked off inside of Meta in partnership kind of as kind of an adjunct to our Llama program. And no matter how many videos you have of somebody grabbing a coffee cup, you're actually not getting the data you need because you don't know the proprioception of how much force was applied and how we detected, okay, this is a plastic cup. It's going to deflect to a certain point. And there's condensation on it. So I need to apply a little bit more force to counter the loss of friction that I'm experiencing. We do that autonomically. There's not a single conscious thought in our head when we're doing those things. Aria, when you're taking your phone out of your pocket, you don't know what the angle of your second digit is or how much force you're applying with your thumb to avoid getting the keys.
Yeah.
To some degree, the things that we think of as intelligence, we're talking about the higher order functions of the human brain. That's arguably the less impressive part of intelligence. The deep brain, the mammalian, the amygdala, that lizard brain intelligence, that is wildly hard for us to capture in the modern era. So as much as I'm excited about the word calculator, I really do believe in Jan LeCun's vision that you have to do this pioneering work to break through to a world model that has common sense, that understands causality in a more substantial way, not in a statistical kind of soup way, but in a model-based way. And then my third layer of this stuff is I want it to be embodied. It almost goes back to like J.C.R. Licklider, who's one of the first computer scientists, says to sit down at a terminal and do a live programming. And he believed in that vision. And he really was the one who then funded what would become SRI, founded Doug Engelbart, funded a bunch of DARPA. It was at the ITO at DARPA. Like, I feel like we're in that era. We're in the terminal era of AI. And it doesn't want to be like that. It wants to be everywhere. It wants to be ubiquitous. It wants to be in full context of what your life is and with history of who you are. I love where we are. I am a huge believer in it. I also want us to invest in these world models, and I want to free it from the terminal.
Is the world models and the free from the terminal, are those fundamentally new, different technologies from the kind of scale transformer? What's the kind of looking through a glass darkly, thinking about how this would be done?
I think the embodied part can do both. The embodied part will benefit a lot and maybe help a lot with world modeling. Once you have these sensors out there and you have better, richer data, when you have robotics data, which will give you proprioception, which will give you friction, like, I think that is going to be a big unlock. It benefits the current models a huge amount to get that data and to be in that context. And also, it probably is some of the data that you need to start to understand what it takes to build a world model, which we appear to be born with.
Tell me about the Orion project. I had the pleasure and honor of coming by, you know, Meta HQ and playing with it and getting some of the detailed exposures. Tell me about like kind of what you see as the significant use cases and where the metaverse is moving towards with Orion.
So we've got the Orion glasses are on right now. I've also got this wristband, this neural interface wristband. It's got these little kind of metal bumps on the back of it, all down the band. EMG sensors, electromyography. They're measuring electrical impulses going down my hand. And what I'm able to do, I've got a screen in front of me so I can do my email. I can do Instagram. We have little games that you can play. I have been caught playing the games in meetings before. They weren't my meetings, to be fair. I was just listening in, but I have been caught. And I can do it with my wrist at rest by using a small number of gestures, but I'm using eye tracking to try to direct things. And so we had to do a lot of tough problem solving on photonics and optics. You have to use a lot of kind of mirrors and reflections and complex geometry. You're making these, you know, absolutely tiny scale consumer electronics. So you're generating these photons. Then you have to bend the photons into the light. We use a thing called a waveguide. And waveguides use the construct of total internal reflection of light, the same way fiber optics work, to try to bend the light in a certain pace. But of course, there's a couple other problems when you have glasses that aren't fiber optics, which are encased in a cover, which is that other photons enter from the world and get caught in those same light pipes. And that can create rainbows and haze and these kind of artifacts that are distracting to you. And then also some of those photons escape. So people outside can sometimes see them. In this case, we have a kind of an exit grating. So you want to minimize the artifacts. Some of the stuff we understand. We understand how to build apps. We understand how to do these things. And there's some novel interaction design here with the wristband and eye tracking. But I think we've made that pretty straightforward. Doing the neural interfaces was super hard. You're building an AI model of what the hand is doing based on these electrical impulses that you're able to observe from the surface. And so you just need a lot of people to build a generalized model that works so that anybody can put this on. And I think we had success with you, Reed. Like, I think we're well into the 95th percentile, I think, of people who put this on and can right away, we know what shape the hand is in. And that allows us to do these gesture-based controls, even with your hands in your pocket, behind your back. These need to be regular glasses first and foremost. When they're powered off, I have to be able to see your eyes to see my eyes. And like that has to be that human connection that we have is important. Otherwise, I wouldn't use the glasses. You have to do all of this in a comfortable, all-day wearable form factor. There's a lot of challenges. You know, this was 10 years in the making. And we thought when we started this program that we had less than 10% chance of being able to build it. So the fact that it exists is a true testament to a vision that Mark Zuckerberg had, that the research team, Michael Abrash, our chief scientist, and his team had for a long, long period of time. Now, we always thought, to your point about the metaverse, that the first thing would happen would be these holograms in the world. And at first, there'd be just referenced to you, so just your personal interface. And then over time, they would be attached in the world. And then eventually, you would have an AI that was doing it. What's been surprising to us is the AI came first. We got the sequencing wrong. The AI showed up earlier than expected. So what's been so exciting is there's a lot of products now that are totally valid products that are easy to use between full AR glasses, which are spectacular, but will be expensive, and the Ray-Ban Metas, which are super affordable, but like on a little bit more limited in their functionality. That entire spectrum is now open to us, and it's really, really exciting. And we have demos internally in our wearables. And with the Ray-Ban Metas that are in market today, through our early access program, you can use this tool called Live AI. 30-minute session until the battery runs out, because it was kind of bolted on after the fact. But for 30 minutes, it can see what you're seeing. It hears what you're hearing. And the difference in how useful it is to me as I go about my day in the world, I was doing a film development project. And film developing is a real fussy business with what kind of chemical, at what temperature, for how long. Usually I'm doing it with like a laptop next to me and I'm trying to type into the laptop, okay, what's the thing? Doing it with the live AI session was incredible. It just sees what you're doing. It's like, okay, you got 20 more minutes of doing that. And then you're going to do this other thing. And why don't you go ahead and prepare this now? It's stunning. So for me, it is about blending the physical and digital together in both directions. You have to give the AI access to the physical context in which you operate and the digital context in which you operate on your desktop or on your phone. And conversely, you want to be able to bring those digital constructs into reality through robotics, through automation. So I see really a very, very exciting kind of decade ahead of us in that synthesis.
So I am someone who sees 90% of my vision out of one eye. Will I be able to use these?
Yes. So these are binocular. You'll experience the same limited depth perception that you would experience normally. That's right.
That I have now. Yeah.
So you'll still be able to use these.
Okay.
Over the future of time, I do expect one of the real option spaces here is, what if you go to monocular? What if you just had the display in one eye?
Yeah.
And there's some challenges there. It creates some binocular rivalry. So for people who have full vision in both eyes, they might struggle sometimes to know, hey, my eyes are seeing different things looking at the same space.
Where should I look? Yeah.
You would actually be better off in those displays.
I love it. Can't wait. I finally have a superpower.
You would have a little superpower. That's right. You'd have a little advantage that monocular displays would probably be great for you. Cheaper, lighter, and probably just as good. So I think you've got maybe a little inside opportunity on the rest of us.
I love it. I love it. Okay. So for some of the skeptics out there, I feel like this is especially a good question for you because you were essentially the person who created the newsfeed. And for those of the youngs among us, they might not remember this, that the newsfeed came out and everyone was like, no, this is horrible. What are we doing? And now we're like, oh, a newsfeed. This makes so much sense. This is perfect. We like can't imagine a world without it. And so some people might be saying the same thing. They might be saying, why are you creating these things that we don't need? Like, what would you say to the skeptics? And then also, as you see people using it, what do you think some of the mainstream adoptions are going to be?
Things like AI are different kinds of things. These are different types of innovations. These are truly new tools. This is a new space. So these are different types of innovations. And my team will tell you, the human says, what human on this earth is better off because they have this? And that involves thinking about what are they doing instead of it? What is their current solution to the problem they have? What is the problem? Is it a big problem? By the way, there's two types of big problems. There's big problems, like rare, but super big. And there's also super common, but small. Those are both collectively big problems that we can go solve. But I'm like, find me the human whose life is just like, oh my God, way better. AI has been uneven at this. The answer for AI so far has been like homework. Like kids doing homework and getting help with homework has been like by far, I think, the number one use case for AI. Number two has been coders who used to go to Stack Overflow. Those are like, these are people who were previously using Google or online resources and are now using a consolidated form of that. But like the smartphone was a kind of a disruptive thing where it was like, hey, you have a phone and you have an iPod and you have like, you like the web. We're going to put all those in one place, right? That was the pitch. This will be similar to that. This will be like, hey, look, you already have a phone that you like doing this. You already like Instagram. This is a better way of doing a thing that you already do. Mm-hmm. And then once you've established that beachhead through comfortable paths, then the huge opportunity presents itself. You know, you talked, Arya, about having superpowers. That is the vision that we have for these wearables. Every person, superhuman vision, superhuman hearing, superhuman memory, superhuman cognition. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I really believe is going to happen here. A tremendous, tremendously equalizing technology. You know, we talk often in our society today about the vagaries of the birth lottery, and we're rightly doing so. We usually talk about the birth lottery in the context of whether it be race and gender or physical geography. And those are hugely important factors in how our lives play out. But we don't talk about the other parts of the birth lottery, who has incredible memory, incredible vision, incredible hearing. Some people are born that just have those talents, incredible ability to think creatively, to pattern match. And there's no reason we couldn't all be Garry Kasparov in chess if we have the wearables. You know what I'm saying? Now, it probably takes the fun out of chess, so I'm not recommending anti-competitive performance. But my point is, like, the vagaries of the bell curve and the ranges of human capabilities are beyond just the demographic ones. They exist in terms of fundamental capabilities. And how interesting will we be as a society if everyone has the full access to those facilities? That is the future I see. And I think that's a pretty compelling pitch to people, to get them to try a new thing.
Exactly. And I'm going to take this moment to ask you a question that I hate getting, so it's kind of entertaining to be the asker of it, which is, you know, if you're predicting out, call it 3 years, you know, and with kind of wearables and AI and everything else, what kinds of things do you see in the future that will be the kind of thing that people will be doing? Is it kind of like it's giving me a constant scan on my life? It's doing the proactive search of, oh, you're looking at like film developing, or you're looking at this thing. Oh, let me tell you some stuff about this. What is your future prediction that might cause, call it semi or non-technologists to go, oh my God, that's coming in 3 years?
Yeah, I think what's interesting, the hard part of this question is the timeline of it. I think you and I probably would do better in 1 year and 10 years.
Yes.
3 years is the most awkward time because, you know, you can kind of, I know 1 year, I have a good sense of 10 years, 3 years is tough. I don't think we'll be at the proactive place in 3 years quite yet. Early adopters will probably have always on systems that are capable of it. The degree to which I think it's going to be reliable enough for the average consumer, I think we're probably a little further out from that, from a world modeling and cognition standpoint. But for a decent portion of people, you know, tens of millions, we're going to have people who are in regular conversation with AIs. everything from, I cook all the time, I'm the cook in my family. Hey, like, you know, how many quarts is it in a gallon? How many, you know, what's the conversion, tablespoons to ounces of water, to, hey, what did my wife say I needed to get at the grocery store? Remind me, she told me yesterday, hey, when I opened the fridge earlier, did we have that cheese that I like, you know?
That's the best one.
And listen, and there's stuff that I really want to push for, but we have to advocate for regulatorily. I mean, I think one of the classic ones is the cocktail party problem. And Reed, you must run into this all the time. You know, you see somebody coming up to you, you recognize them, you know them. You don't remember why you know them or how you know them. And right now we're just like, hey guy, good to see you, you know, friend. Like, and you're just like looking for clues to try to remember. I'd love to be able to have your AI whisper to you like, hey, you know, this is this person. The last time you saw them was here. They, you know, and you're like, oh, right. And that kind of thing. But that one we need help with, right? There's regulations in Illinois and Texas, BIPA and QB, that make that kind of thing tenuous at best, if it's doable.
Hi, I'm Pi. Allow me to provide some context. BIPA, an Illinois state regulation, focuses on protecting individuals' biometric information, such as fingerprints, voice prints, and retina scans. It requires companies to obtain written consent and provide notice before collecting this data. BIPA also restricts companies from disclosing or selling biometric information without consent and holds them accountable for safeguarding it. QB, a Texas state regulation, also aims to protect individuals' biometric identifiers. It requires companies to inform individuals and obtain their consent before capturing biometric data. QB ensures companies secure this information and places limitations on its sale or disclosure. However, enforcement of QB primarily falls to the Texas Attorney General.
So there's a bunch of very human problems where we could be a little bit more proactive, and I think comfortably so, in a totally privacy way, secure way. We've got to do work. So 3 years from now, I do think you'll be in this kind of people at the leading edge, not the earliest adopters, not the bleeding edge, just the leading edge, just the early adopters, will be having tremendous usefulness, kind of cognition and memory help from their assistants.